15 years ago to talk about cruise ships up near Barrow would just be someone's imagination. That is now reality.
A new Arctic policy from the Bush administration. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Night for Friday, the 9th of January. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, the U.S. Supreme Court prepares to hear the Kensington Mine case.
Through the years, with all the various projects that we've proposed and developed, we've been stymied at every turn.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
President George W. Bush has signed into law a new policy for the Arctic just 10 days before he's set to leave office. The policy has not yet been made public. The White House is expected to release it on Monday. It's the first time in 15 years that a president has crafted a directive for the far north. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says it gives recommendations to federal agencies.
Call it a guideline, call it a blueprint of how within certain areas the United States as an Arctic nation moves forward, whether it's in meeting security issues or environmental issues or how we deal with the indigenous people or the scientific and research matters.
The new Arctic policy has been in the works for more than a year. Senator Murkowski was the only member of Congress to actively participate in the process. She says it's important the policy come out now before the Bush administration leaves office because so much work has gone into it.
I will be honest with you, though. I have been very disappointed that it has taken as long as it has. We appreciate the deliberations and all that has to go on within the administration and the various levels that it needs to go through. But we have been waiting for the final sign-off on this now for about 6 months. And I was a little concerned that we were going to run out of this administration before the policy was released.
The chairman of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, Mead Treadwell, here in Anchorage, says as the clock started to run out on President Bush's time in office, there were some who thought the incoming Obama administration should craft the policy. But Treadwell is glad it moved forward. It will still be up to President-elect Obama to decide how much to implement the policy. But Treadwell says it's not about politics as much as it's about raising awareness that America is an Arctic nation, even though many in the United States may not think of their country that way.
You've now had a process that looks at the Arctic and says the Arctic matters to the United States in these ways. And it really leaves a big to-do list for the next administration. It says, let's get together with the other countries and work to make sure that shipping is safe and secure and reliable. Let's work with the other countries on fisheries. Let's do the research necessary to expand the borders of the United States in the Arctic Ocean.
Treadwell also hopes the new policy supports unfettered access for scientific research. He and Murkowski haven't seen the version Bush signed into law today, but they've seen a working draft. Treadwell says a lot has changed in the 15 years since U.S. Arctic policy was last updated. He says back in 1994, the focus was entirely different.
There was no mention of climate change at all. There was no discussion of the potential for Arctic shipping and the needs that nations have to cooperate to make sure that shipping is safe, secure, reliable. There was certainly strong support given for international science cooperation, but not really for the kind of monitoring networks that we now have in mind.
Senator Murkowski agrees that in recent years, the Arctic has changed dramatically because of the warming climate and melting sea ice.
What we're seeing is a level of maritime commerce up north that we have not seen before. 15 years ago, to talk about cruise ships up near Barrow would just be someone's imagination. That is now reality.
One of the more controversial elements in the new policy is support of the Law of the Sea Convention. The U.S. has not signed onto the treaty, which governs international waters. President Bush has come out in favor of ratifying it, but some of the more conservative members of his administration disagree. They say the U.S. should not sign on. Senator Murkowski says that internal debate may have held up releasing the Arctic policy.
it is possible that because of the controversy that does surround ratification on the Convention of the Law of the Sea, that that was one of the reasons that this was held up within the Bush administration. But it just serves to emphasize the significance of ratification of that treaty to include that in this updated U.S. Arctic policy.
Murkowski says she believes it's important for the U.S. to sign the Law of the Sea Treaty so it can have a seat at the table for discussions about nations' borders in the North. Mead Treadwell agrees. He says if the U.S. wants to make a claim to extend its continental shelf, that could be done through the treaty.
And that would mean that there would be new extended continental shelf territory off of Alaska that could be larger than the state of California. So that's a very positive change for Alaska, and of course that means that once that ownership is understood, ultimately resource development could be considered.
The conservative Washington think tank, the Heritage Foundation, is against the Law of the Sea Treaty. Foundation fellow Stephen Groves says he's afraid it would give environments more influence in the North. He also says it means more regulation for the United States. He says if something needs to be negotiated with another Arctic nation, the U.S. can do it one-on-one.
We'll come to an accord on our own between the two countries. We don't need to be part of this this international socialist redistributionist treaty to come to an agreement about where our continental shelf starts and ends. We can do that on our own.
It's up to the U.S. Senate to pass the Law of the Sea Treaty. The other suggestions of the new Arctic policy will be officially released on Monday. This year's legislative session is starting to ramp up in Juneau. Lawmakers today released the first batch of bills available for consideration this year and next, the first of many. Among the 120 bills and resolutions are some we're sure to hear about in the future. Joining us now is APRN's Dave Donaldson in Juneau. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Is there any particular focus with these bills, any common, I don't know, philosophic base from what you can see?
Not really. These come in from every direction, from every political perspective. What's common is that they represent the personal desires and opinions of the sponsors. And you know, that's really widespread. That just shows how widespread this state is and the legislature actually is. There is a lot of repetition, though. There's a lot of people who have the same ideas and many multiple sponsors of the same bills. A lot of co-sponsors in there. So there is some cross support of things, some cross ideas.
What's getting a lot of support?
Well, a couple of them are really got quite a few people signed on to them. One of the top ones is a bill that would forbid the state, including the permanent fund, from investing in companies that do business in the Sudan. That's because of the genocide in Darfur. Six members have signed on to bills that would already, I mean, this is with the first day here, that would set up a way for the state to show its basic distaste for what's happening over there. It was up last year, but the Palin administration showed some early resistance to it coming from the Revenue Department and also from the Permanent Fund. But the governor got behind it, but just too late to pass. So when the subject came up in this year, last fall's vice presidential debate, Governor Palin mentioned it. She really backed it, and that kind of breathed some new life into this subject. And I think it'll get a lot of widespread support because of that. The other main one is changing the state's retirement system. There are 11 people sponsoring several bills that would repeal what was done in 2005, a bill that Frank Murkowski pushed through. What that bill did was that it set up a system that limits the state's responsibility to retirees to their contributions toward their private retirement accounts. And the state's had a lot of trouble hiring new employees, and these bills all out there right now would all return the guaranteed pension so that when somebody retires, the state has a required, guaranteed, defined benefit that they're going to be giving to people.
All right. Well, it can all be one big happy family down there. Where's the controversy coming from this year?
The big controversy is going to be, I think, capital punishment. Total surprise to me. I didn't expect it. I don't think anybody even ever predicted it. It's a heavyweight bill by the new Speaker of the House, Mike Chenault. It actually, it approves the death penalty for murder cases and seems to be pretty stringent in its requirements. There's a lot of argument about the bill already. About 10 years ago, there was a bill that was introduced that would have asked the public in a public vote, do you want the death penalty or not? That got national attention from various groups and people out there of different sides of the question. It was a major noisy argument and finally got rejected because it really did cause a lot of introspection from members as to what they really thought about it. This simply puts a death chamber somewhere in the state and it's over with. It's going to be very noisy, and I think we'll hear a lot about this one.
All right. I'm sure there are a few things in these bills and resolutions that are out there, but we'll never hear from again. What's in there?
Well, yeah, I'm never surprised with what sometimes they'll put into law. There's one that very unfortunately it graphically describes and prohibits bestiality. And another one is an idea that comes up every few years. You get rid of daylight savings time. Another one would give the extra $1,200 dividend that everybody got last year, but it would give it to those people who didn't get the $1,200 last year. The thing is that there are a lot of bills that will get some serious attention among these personal ones. For example, one of them rewrites the state's mining tax. That's an issue more likely to get promoted possibly next year. But it is a major, long-awaited idea that's out there, and it's being sponsored by a Republican. It's got a lot of Republican support. There are others, but there are a lot of bills that prove this is going to be an interesting session that doesn't focus on just one or two issues like we've seen in the past 2 years, so they kind of become repetitive and boring. There's going to be a lot of stuff happening here.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing all about it as we go forward. Dave, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a recession-friendly event in Anchorage this weekend.
That moment that you don't have to worry about the money. When we look in the wallet and no money, forget about it. Let's go easy free.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments Monday on a case that will decide if the Kensington Gold Mine can discharge tailings in a freshwater lake. Mine owners Kuralaska appealed to the High Court after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2007 struck down the company's permit to dump mine waste into Lower Slate Lake. Siding with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council and other environmental groups, the appeals court said the plan violated the Clean Water Act. For more than 30 years, it's been illegal for new gold mines to discharge waste into lakes or rivers, but the Bush administration has interpreted Clean Water Act regulations differently. Earth Justice Attorney Tom Waldo argued the case before the Ninth Circuit and now before the Supreme Court.
Those rules have required mining companies to use settling ponds and other technologies to reduce solids from their discharges so that the water that's actually discharged into lakes and rivers and streams is clean. And this is the first time since the enactment of the Clean Water Act that the Corps of Engineers has tried to authorize the discharge of tailings directly into a lake or another water body. We think the plain language of the Clean Water Act prohibits that. We think the plain language of the agency's regulations prohibits that.
The state of Alaska has joined the mining company in the case. Former U.S. Solicitor General under Bush, Ted Olson, will be arguing the case for the federal agencies that approved the Lower Slate Lake tailings plan. Goldbelt, Juneau's urban native corporation, has filed a petition supporting Kuralaska. The Ninth Circuit Court invalidated invalidated Gold Belt's permit to construct a marine terminal for the Kensington mine at Cascade Point, though it was a separate project and not part of the mine's tailing plan. Gold Belt received the Cascade Point land north of Juneau in exchange for holdings on Admiralty Island. Gold Belt board member Randy Wanamaker says the case is more than an interpretation of the Clean Water Act. It's a social justice issue.
We received that land after reaching agreement with the environmental groups that we could enjoy the quiet use of our land to promote the socioeconomic well-being of our tribal members in return for leaving Admiralty Island. But that hasn't happened. Through the years, with all the various projects that we've proposed and developed, we've been stymied at every turn.
Wanamaker says the Ninth Circuit's decision to vacate Gold Belt's permit has caused severe economic damage to the corporation and to its shareholders. The corporation hopes the Cascade Point permit could be reinstated if the Supreme Court upholds Korolaska's tailings plan. The environmental groups are supported by several Bristol Bay area native organizations and fishing groups fighting the Pebble Mine project. If the High Court rules with the mining company and allows tailings to be dumped into the lake, they fear a precedent would be set that would allow mine waste in lakes and streams elsewhere. The Supreme Court takes up the Kensington mine question at 10 a.m. on Monday morning. The court will not rule on the case until spring. Sitka's historic Japonski Island Boathouse is moving into the architectural phase of its planned restoration. The garage-like structure at the foot of the O'Connell Bridge is one of the dwindling number of small utilitarian buildings that comprised the Sitka Naval Air Station during World War II. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
In 2007, the Sitka Maritime Heritage Society won a $90,000 scenic byways grant to develop plans to rehabilitate the structure into a World War II interpretive center and a working wooden boat shop and commercial fishing museum. The award took nearly a year to work its way through the State Department of Transportation. Maritime Heritage Society President Rebecca Polson told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce this week that her organization has just begun soliciting architectural proposals for the restoration of the original historic structure, plus a modern, fully accessible addition for visitors. Polson argued that the downturn in the national economy was all the more reason to invest now in Sitka's visitor infrastructure.
I believe that even in a recession, we will do better by attracting travelers looking for a good value, a memorable, unique, rewarding trip, the real thing, rather than a place just like all the rest.
Polson referred to recent emphasis on the Sitka Historic Preservation Plan and said that we need to preserve the places we want to promote. Polson said the boathouse moved from federal to state ownership in the decades following the war, at about the same time Mount Edgecombe High School went to the state. It was under the management of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources and likely would have become a parking lot, according to Polson, if the Maritime Heritage Society had not stepped in to help the city acquire it. The society acquired the site by lease from the city in 2004 and has since spent $65,000 in grant funding working to stabilize the structure. Early last year, the society signed a sublease with Delta Western to allow the fuel supplier to construct a dock and storage tanks on the uplands between the boathouse and the city work float. Polson said the deal will pay the society 6.5 cents per gallon, a minimum of $50,000 and a maximum of $75,000 per year. The city subsequently has faced a legal challenge from Petromarine, the existing fuel supplier. Polson told the chamber that the deal is critical to the society's long-term future.
Anyone involved in nonprofits knows that unrestricted, dependable operating income is crucial for existence and the very hardest to come by. The income will not only support operation, and with a paid staff person, things might go a little faster, but it will give confidence in our stability to foundations as we ask them for major donations.
Despite the recent controversy over the Delta Western sublease, the chamber audience limited its questions largely to maritime heritage. The possible connection between the Boathouse Interpretive Center and the new Fort Rousseau Causeway State Historic Park, and the difficulties involved in maintaining wooden boats. Polson said the society would be cautious about taking on too many boats due to the expense involved, but added that it was simply impossible to resist some watercraft. She gave the chamber its first lesson in Sitka maritime history.
It's actually a kind of boat that was developed here called a Sitka sealer or a sealing boat that was, you know, in the 22, 24 feet long, that was developed in response to a law that restricted fur seal hunting to natives and a boat with no motor and no firearms and only five or fewer crew. And so this boat, they're long and skinny, incredibly fast, with four rowing stations, you know, one person to an oar. And they used to go out from Bjorka, you know, to intercept the fur seals when they were going by. And then after that ended, they still were around and they would have races in the 30s.
Polson also said that the society was partial to Davis boats, which were built in a small factory in Metlakatla. A sailing canoe named the Nakwasina, owned by the Calvin family, which was the subject of a National Geographic article, and the same boats built in Peter Simpson's shop at what was then known as Sheldon Jackson School. Polson said the idea of a maritime heritage center here only makes sense because we have such a rich tradition from Tlingit mariners, Russian boat builders, the military and commercial fishermen, and all of us who still find our bliss on the water. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States.
The U.S. National Cross Country Ski Championships wrapped up in Anchorage yesterday. Temperature warmed up enough to get in a sprint competition, with Olympians Chris Freeman of New Hampshire and Keegan Randall of Anchorage easily winning the men's and women's events. The sprint was just one of two of four that were held due to extreme cold that forced several days of cancellations. The results of the two races and those from other big events earlier this season were used to select 33 skiers, including 11 Alaskans, to compete in international competitions in Europe and Canada this winter. The weather likely won't stop the 20th running of the Copper Basin 300 Sled Dog Race. The season's first big mid-distance event is scheduled to get underway tomorrow at Lake Louise. Temperatures along the race trail have been as cold as 50 below zero. Organizers met last night to talk about contingencies if things don't warm up. And race board president Marty Cardula says the event will go off in some form.
There's a possibility we may delay the race for an hour, and then there's that possibility we delay the race for a full day. At this point, all I can tell you is that we're planning to run this race.
Cardula says the Copper Basin 300 has only been canceled once in the last 19 years. In 1996, the race was halted during the first day when the temperature fell to 62 below zero. He says an expected warm-up keeps getting pushed back in the forecast, but that there's also concern about heavy snow when it arrives.
What if this system comes in and it just dumps 2 feet and starts snowing, you know, at the rate of 2 inches an hour? Well, we've got over a dozen people with machines ready to break, you know, so we can delay just to stay in front of the teams. And I think we're going to be in good shape.
Cardula says the Copper Valley has the best snow cover in 4 years, with anywhere from 20 inches to 5 feet along the trail. 30 teams are signed up to compete in the Copper Basin so far, with a few last-minute entries still possible. Defending and three-time race champion Alan Moore of Two Rivers is running, as is his wife, former Yukon Quest winner Allie Zirkel. Defending Iditarod and Quest champ Lance Mackey is also signed up. Missing from the roster is last year's fourth-place finisher, Sigrid Ekron. The Norwegian musher was on her way to winning the 2008 race when she went on the wrong way at an intersection near the finish. Cardula says officials plan to better mark the tricky spot before mushers get there.
Try to keep our snow machines out of Moose Lake. That's what happened last year. Ended up dumping a machine, and what we didn't do was X off that it's like a main highway. We had the stakes there showing the turn, but we didn't have the X's blocking off that main freeway.
Cogula says, barring a similar disaster, trailbreakers will be well ahead of the dog teams and have the intersection more clearly marked. The 300-mile trail loop along the Richardson, Glen, and Toke cutoff highways remains the same this year, but the start and finish of the race have been changed from Glen Allen to Lake Louise. The race purse is $18,000. A concert tomorrow night at the Atwood Concert Hall in Anchorage is highlighting the struggle for freedom in Tibet. Karma Lama, a Tibetan man who has lived in Alaska for more than a decade, is helping organize the event. Karma Lama grew up in India and Nepal after his parents fled Chinese rule in Tibet. He says he hopes to raise awareness about the plight of his people in his homeland.
We have a situation of the Tibet. People are suffering a lot for the human rights.
The event will feature a talk from a former political prisoner from Tibet, Tibetan musicians, and Alaska's own tribal funk band, Bumyua. Karma Lama is also performing himself with his group Culture Brothers, a Tibetan Yupik fusion band. Karma Lama says he and his wife have put in some long days recently organizing the show.
We work like at least 16 hours there, and sometimes we can't even sleep. And we never give up. We always say, okay, let's do this one more hour. One more hour, then it ends up the 6, 7 morning. By the time we're ready to go sleep, and we will just keep thinking how we bring this best that we can do this in the event. You know? So we are constantly working.
He says this is the first free Tibet concert in Alaska. He thinks the message of peace, freedom, and preserving indigenous cultures will resonate well with Alaskans.
From my own experience, learning about the culture of the Alaskan people who live here first, and their part of their lifestyle, our Tibetan lifestyle, is not really different, the way they live a lifestyle.
Tomorrow's concert is free, and Karma Lama says there won't be anything to buy at the event. Even snacks and water will be provided. He said he's excited to offer a money-free zone for the audience.
We don't have to bring like money in the wallet, you know, like that moment that you don't have to worry about the money. When we look in the wallet, no money, forget about it. Let's go, it's free. So that way, people should be really relaxed and they really enjoy and learn. And when they're going back home, they can take with them the good music, good story. And that was free.
Tickets are available at retailers and coffee shops around Anchorage, including the Taproot Cafe and Woolies. They'll also be distributed at the Atwood Concert Hall before the event, which starts at 7 p.m. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster, and I'm Duncan Moon. Have a good weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.